Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It is the Brian Lehrer Show. Brian is not here today. Filling in, I'm Juan Manuel Benitez, the host of Pura Politica on New York One Noticias. Let's talk numbers. Let's start with 5%. Of all people, all the people in the world, 5% of them live here in the United States. Another number, 25%. Of all the world's prisoners, 25% of them, or 1 out of 4, are behind bars here in America. One more number, 13, as in the 13th Amendment of the Constitution. 13th is the title of a new documentary now in theaters and on Netflix that explores how we got here, how the U.S. managed to have more than 2,300,000 people in prison. The film was directed by Ava DuVernay, who also directed the Oscar-nominated film Selma. And just a quick American history refresher for all of you, the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution was the one that abolished slavery. Is there a connection between this amendment and mass incarceration in the U.S.? We're going to talk about this and more with our guests. Two of them are featured in the movie. Khalil Gibran Muhammad is a professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. And Nicholas Turner, he is the president and director of the Vera Institute, an organization that has as a mission to drive change, to urgently build and improve justice systems that ensure fairness, promote safety, and strengthen communities. Also with us today, Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance. Thank you all for being here with us.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Nick. Tell us about the so-called loophole in the 13th Amendment.
So the 13th Amendment, as you just mentioned, Juan Manuel, abolished slavery except for in circumstances when someone had been duly convicted of a crime. And so that loophole really allowed the South, which if you think about it, slavery ended. Millions of slaves are free. That was the labor force. That was the engine of the Southern economy, which all of a sudden was depleted. And so what happened in the South, and I think Khalil can probably speak to this with far more authority than I can, was that in Reconstruction, there were a set of practices where blacks were increasingly arrested for vagrancy, loitering, things of that nature, and put to work. And there's a practice called convict leasing. Right. And so in factories and farms, black folks were rounded up. In the movie, Michelle Alexander makes the point that this was America's first incarceration binge. And so that is the loophole that the movie speaks about.
So, Khalil, was the loophole in the 13th Amendment done in purpose? So there was a purpose to it?
Well, the 13th Amendment built on pre-existing legislation going back to the 18th century, particularly the Northwest Ordinance, which was a grand bargain to open up the West for white settlers in exchange for restricting slavery to the South effectively. And in that ordinance in 1787 included a clause that essentially allowed for slavery to continue in portions of the Northwest Ordinance that was a product of people having committed crimes or been convicted of crimes. So there's a linkage to slavery as an institution and the 13th Amendment that even precedes 1865. But the fact of the matter is that there is no construct where someone can be enslaved but for the problem of the presence of black people in America. So you can't separate those two things and their intentionality.
Right. And Khalil, and you wrote a piece for The Nation magazine in which you claim that law enforcement has been the foot soldiers of the system. What do you mean by this?
Well, we can't have a massive criminal justice system where 25% of the world's prisoners are in cages here in the United States, but they're only 5% of the world's population, but for law enforcement action. People don't end up facing criminal charges or in courts and therefore convicted and punished, but for the fact that policing is the gateway to this process. So you essentially, if we have a mass incarceration problem, we also must have a policing problem at some core level.
So, Mr. Vance, as part of that law enforcement system, do you agree with this?
Well, I think, Khalil, that there's no question that as a law enforcement community, we absolutely have to evaluate, and I think differently than we have historically, who is going to prison and why we are asking them to be put there. I started as an assistant district attorney in Manhattan years ago in 1982. And when I started, I was struck powerfully by the reality that 90% of the men and women who come through our court every day, as I was working in court, are men and women of color. And I left the DA's office in the late 80s and worked in private practice, but I came back to run for DA in 2009. And when I was DA and returned to court, what struck me is that 30 years later, I saw exactly the same thing that I saw 30 years before. 90% of the men and women in our court are men and women of color. And so I think as a law enforcement community, we have to just – we can't deny the fact, and we have to acknowledge that those who are coming into our system, at least in the major metropolitan areas, are disproportionately men and women of color. So then we have to ask ourselves, how did we get here, and what can we do to change that picture? And on that note, I'm sure we'll discuss it, but I think there are – you know, there are many positive and I think impactful steps that prosecutors are taking in my office and around the country in order to be smarter, more intelligent about who comes into the criminal justice system and smarter and more intelligent about during any stay in jail that those individuals are given the skills, the education, and the opportunities to succeed when they come back home.
So let me say that this documentary, 13th, is beautifully done, extremely informative, and extremely upsetting, and I'm sure it's really upsetting for men of color. The presidential candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, appear in the movie. Let's listen to this short clip.
They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy.
Group of kids who are growing up essentially fatherless, godless, and jobless.
For me, what's more disturbing is the degree to which black people bought into that.
Animals, beasts that needed to be controlled.
When those grandmothers say, but he's a good boy. He never did anything. Don't you believe it?
Many black communities began to actually support policies that criminalize their own children.
Last night, the 18s accused in the attack were arraigned on charges of rape and attempted murder.
In the Central Park jogger case, they put five innocent teens in prison because the public pressure to lock up these quote-unquote animals was so strong.
You better believe that I hate the people that took this girl and raped her brutally. You better believe it.
That clip started with Hillary Clinton, ended with Donald Trump talking about the Central Park Five. And Hillary Clinton has been heavily criticized for her comments on super predators. And Bill Clinton has acknowledged that his 1994 crime bill was a mistake. The 90s saw an increase of almost a million people in the prison population. Khalil, how are black voters dealing with this and Hillary Clinton's candidacy for president?
Well, overwhelmingly, this is not an issue for black voters who are supporting Hillary Clinton. She's polling extremely high in the 80s, just a little bit less than Obama was. Her weakness is, of course, with younger voters. But the question of black voters as a demographic, this is not an issue. That doesn't mean fundamentally that the underlying problem and the excesses and the appeal to racism that we hear in those clips from Nixon to Reagan to Clinton to the Clintons and more recently Donald Trump is not a problem. But for most voters, they will address those problems in the work that has to happen in terms of policy work and advocacy work after the election.
And Nick, the Republican candidate for president, Donald Trump, talks a lot about the need for law and order. And this concept has a long history in American politics and is also directly linked to the actual system. Tell us about it.
Well, you know, Khalil used a phrase, appeal to racism, and really what the candidate's doing is no different than what we've seen through history. And there are lots of clips in the film about Nixon saying the very same thing, you know, calling for law and order, talking about unrest and civil disorder in our cities, which was a coded way of raising fears and concerns that Americans had. Post civil rights and concerns about black folks and this connection that people carry around with them in this society, which of black criminality, and so he's tapping into that, and he's doing it in a way that is very reminiscent of the way which other historical figures have done, which is that it's largely fact free. I mean, he talks about huge rises in crime, except the fact of the matter is that we are near the trough in terms of crime in this country, in terms of violent crime, property crime. There has been a very slight spike in the past few years, and he's exploiting that to increase fears. But in fact, after 25 years of massive crime reduction in this country, we are as safe as we have been in a long time. And so it's that kind of opportunism that then taps into people's fears, and everything that we heard on the clip is exactly what we're seeing in current times.
But a lot of people can say, well, it's just law and order. It doesn't have anything to do with the black people specifically. But we have in the movie like proof that during the Nixon administration, there was a conscious effort, Khalil, there was a conscious effort to really basically establish a system to keep black citizens down, or at least not to give them all the opportunities that other citizens of this country enjoyed up to that point. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So most people think that this problem begins in the late 1960s with the election of Richard Nixon. And there is incredibly damning evidence presented in the film among Nixon's close advisors, who are essentially saying, if you appeal to Southern whites, you will move them from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party on the basis of their anxieties about civil rights, about black power, about the increasing presence of a strong and militant voice in black America demanding equality. But this is really just a repeat of the same kinds of politics that shaped the period immediately following slavery, which was a politics of retribution against African Americans for wanting to claim their very civil rights. And the criminal justice system, as Michelle Alexander says in the film, exploded with regard to its capacity to coerce black people either to be subservient sharecroppers or to be prison laborers working in convict lease arrangements.
So, Nick, did the media play a role in all this? Because we're blaming politicians and policymakers, but how about the media?
No, unquestionably, the media played a role in all of this. I mean, I think that one of the mistakes that we sometimes make is that we think, and you even see it in the film. I mean, there's a clip from Ehrlichman who says, yes, it was absolutely intentional. But the fact of the matter is that the words that people use and the images that people conjure, people need to be responsible for that, knowing what we do about how people think. So media focusing on things like, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, and focusing on crime and violent crime and the kinds of things that sort of escalate fears taps into what I would describe as the vast pool of implicit bias, so not necessarily even a purposeful bias that exists in this country. I think it's impossible for anyone in this country not to carry around implicit bias. And in some way, as a result of this media diet, as a result of everything that we're buffeted in this by in the society, to unconsciously connect black skin with criminality. So the media is responsible, but there are lots of studies, psychology studies and others that show that many of us carry these things around, and you have to accept that responsibility as a communicator, whether you're the media or whether you're a presidential candidate or whomever, and recognize that when you are pulling on these strings, you're pulling them in very specific ways that damage a particular class of people.
Mr. Vance, having all this information, right, over the years and now realizing why we are where we are, why doesn't the system change overnight? Why can maybe offices like yours change the way they do their job to rectify this big problem for a huge percentage of the population?
I think when we talk about criminal justice in America, we often don't talk about how fractured it is in various parts of the country. So we typically talk about criminal justice thinking of the federal government and its impact on criminal justice policy through the Department of Justice. In reality, Juan Manuel, the federal government plays a small role in terms of percentage in the criminal justice system. 95% of the cases that are brought in court are brought in state courts around the country. So to answer your question, you have thousands of local law enforcement agencies as well as elected district attorneys for each county making independent decisions. They don't have – we don't have a Justice Department for local prosecutors, a national organizing authority. We are all operating independently, hopefully thoughtfully. So therefore, it behooves all of us who are elected as district attorneys to individually step up and acknowledge some of the realities of the criminal justice system that we inherited and to make sure that during the time we're privileged to hold our offices, we move the ball forward. One of the first things that I did when I became DA was to reach out to the Vera Institute of Justice, which Nick now leads, and ask them in 2010 to come and do a racial bias review of the Manhattan DA's office. That took several years. It was a detailed study. But the point was I was asked to comment upon police practice and race in the criminal justice system. I needed to know in our office, in the Manhattan DA's office, how do we look statistically. Nick's study, and we worked long and hard with Nick until it was published and is now on the Vera site and our website, acknowledges that in certain limited categories in our office there were racial disparities, which now I, as the DA, know what levers I can pull in terms of policy and programming to try to affect change. But more broadly, what the Vera study did for our office is to have me really rethink who we should be bringing to court in the first place. If we have 90% of people coming to our court are young men and women of color, I think responsibly a district attorney can say, can I alter the path of these cases to a different outcome, perhaps diversionary outcome for the large number of minor offenders with minor crimes, and really approach the justice process more intelligently, trying to get the same results in public safety without sacrificing fairness, as well as what I think is move the profession forward toward a fairer, a more understandable, a justice system in which the communities and communities of color in particular can have more confidence in.
I think Cy, let me make a few points if I can, Juan Manuel. I think Cy is absolutely right. I mean, one of the failures of American understanding of the criminal justice system is that people think it's a system, but it's not. There are 18,000 law enforcement agencies in this country. They are locally, municipally run. There are 2,300 elected district attorneys. There are 50 different states that run their own sentencing regimes, that pass legislation, that provide oversight to corrections agencies. And so we're talking about this massively diffuse network of folks. And there's no one lever necessarily that drives change within the whole system. And the folks that run these various agencies have been swimming in a soup of connecting law and order to something that will deliver your safety. But in fact, it's this coded call, sort of this coded racism, and we've been swimming in it for four decades. So then it becomes very hard to think about how you address this challenge and how you get the system to actually turn around after four decades of doing things in a particular way. And I want to give Cy credit, as he said when he was elected, he did something highly unusual, highly novel, which is he said, like, I want to look at what my office is doing. I want to take responsibility for it. If there's racial disparity in the decisions that we're making, then I need to know that and I need to react. And what this justice system needs is that people like Tsai should no longer be a novelty. They should be the norm. And we're not there yet, but it requires all prosecutors to do the same thing, to look at what Tsai Vance did. And if I could also take a brief moment to say what Ken Thompson did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, may he rest in peace. But he was elected to, on a platform so that he wanted to challenge mass incarceration and racial disparity. And we need much more of that.
That was my next question for the DA. Ken Thompson was your colleague, and he died on Sunday unexpectedly. He was implementing a lot of changes in his office. Can you speak briefly about those? I'm sure you're familiar with them. And if you're implementing the same changes in your office?
I think Ken, when he became district attorney, immediately set about to be able to prove to his constituents that there was justice in the Brooklyn County criminal justice system, that it was going to be fair, and that he was going to put his mark on the criminal justice system through the policies that he implemented. So we have all learned much, in my opinion, from Ken's development of the unit in his office that reviews criminal convictions. We opened a unit in 2010, a conviction integrity unit, but I've looked at Ken's unit subsequently to challenge our own handling of review of convictions and adapted some of the important aspects Ken had with his. So Ken made a big commitment to give the public confidence that his office was prepared to be self-aware and analyze cases the office had previously handled if he felt there was an injustice. I think Ken was also very strong in terms of trying to look for options to arrest and incarceration if there were diversionary options. And again, Ken and I, we worked collaboratively, frankly, on several of those along with the NYPD. I think it's safe to say during the few years Ken was the Brooklyn DA, he became recognized as an innovator and leader in fair and effective criminal justice practices. And the National District Attorney's community, I think, lost someone who had already made a mark but who had an incredibly bright future. That said, I have every confidence that whoever succeeds Ken in the short term and the long term will, as a new prosecutor, as I believe prosecutors, particularly in major cities all over the country, are doing what Nick is asking them to do. We all, in my opinion, understand much better. We can't equate safety with simply percentage of convictions and number of arrests. Safety is achieved through crime prevention. If I can keep a gun out of the hand of a 16-year-old and prevent a shooting in northern Manhattan, that's a better outcome and is the kind of crime reduction that I want to achieve if I can avoid prosecuting that young man. So I think that's a trend around the country. We can always do better. I do think that DAs need to own the power that they have and to get out of front on our criminal justice system challenges.
And Khalil, what do you think is going to be President Obama's legacy in this issue, knowing, as we've spoken here about how the federal government doesn't have that much power, what do you think is going to be his legacy?
I think his legacy will be complicated. For much of his two terms, he was not a forceful advocate for fundamentally rolling back the federal legislation first and secondarily setting a moral standard for what punishment should be in America, which, of course, it takes place at the state level, as Nick and Tsai have pointed out. He did help and sign the 2010 Fair Sentencing Act, which reduced the disparity between what would trigger mandatory minimums, 100 to 1 crack versus powder, down to 18 to 1. But of course, then and now, people say, well, you're still placing a premium on a drug that was identified with the black community. Fast forward to the last 12 months, he's the first sitting president to visit a federal penitentiary. He has commuted 600-plus people for nonviolent low-level drug offenses and has taken a forceful stand in terms of deploying resources at the Department of Justice through Eric Holder and then Loretta Lynch to investigate police abuses in many cities across America. These are all things that will stand the test of time as the right things to do in the right moment, but they will be contextualized as minor approaches to a massive problem. I also just want to add that we really want to downsize the criminal justice system, and that we, I speak for, is the film, large advocacy communities, and myself as a scholar of this issue. We've put police officers, prosecutors, courts, and legislators front and seat in addressing systemic inequality in America, particularly racial inequality. If we continue to have a conversation about public safety that is led by our prosecutors and by police officers, then we're missing the big picture. And the big picture is that policing and the system of criminal justice has long been an instrument of exploiting or containing populations in this country. All of them poor, but overwhelmingly disproportionately black or increasingly brown if you happen to live in southwestern parts of the United States or certain pockets in California and New York. And that's a big problem. So until we deal with that problem, which is why the film makes an argument about the slave loophole and makes a connection from slavery to the present, then we're really just tinkering around the edges and working on small ball lever changes that will really metastasize into some new problem that we have in a post-mass incarceration era.
Juan Manuel?
Yep. Go ahead.
Another thing that we often don't talk about, but as a local prosecutor listening to what Khalil just said, I feel is also relevant to remember. The most effective crime fighting and crime prevention strategies are employment and education. As a country, we have failed to provide in certain of our communities, many of them inner city, adequate educational opportunity or equal educational opportunity or employment. And I think as a country, as a state legislature, as a federal legislature, from the executive level, this is a big part of the problem. Police officers and prosecutors, we have to be more thoughtful, and I think we are becoming more thoughtful. But at the end of the day, we end up dealing with young men and women who are already in trouble, in many cases having been in trouble many times. And so it's not just police and prosecutors, clearly, who have the power to fix what goes into our criminal justice system. It's the country to have the commitment that it will actually provide the opportunities equally in all our communities that I think is the fundamental basis upon which we can turn around the rise, you know, the level of crime and the fact that we have ridiculously 2 million people to put in prison.
And at the end of the movie, or the movie, it's not that optimistic, Nick. It doesn't really end with a positive message of this is going to get fixed and we know how to fix it. What would you say to those people who are counting on people like you and organizations like yours to change the system? Do you think it's a battle that is already lost?
Well, I actually think, the movie does two things. I mean, one, it doesn't provide a menu of solutions, but what it actually does in a very hopeful way is it points to Black Lives Matter and this massive grassroots movement that I think all of us are seeing across this country and recognizing that this is the next chapter of a modern civil rights movement and that we're seeing it grow, and that kind of manifestation of democracy is crucial to be able to tackle this. So I think it's optimistic in that sense. But I think this also points to, you know, it's great that you have a historian on this in Khalil, and the movie obviously tells a story of a thread of oppression that's existed in this country for hundreds of years. And we have to look at it in that sense, that this is not only about the kind of good work that Cy does or what Ken Thompson had done or sentencing reform, but this is a national imperative to come to terms with our original sin. And that may feel big and existential and overwhelming, but there are other countries that have done this. You know, Khalil and I took a trip to Germany with a number of people last year, and we recognized how that country's commitment to human dignity was very much rooted in it coming to terms with the Holocaust and it coming to terms with the fact that its law enforcement agencies were used as functionaries of oppression, as functionaries of genocide. And when you look at its justice system, it is a remarkably different thing than we have here. They incarcerate at a tenth the rate that we do. They are organized entirely around helping people to succeed when they're released. There are no such things as these long sentences that we have in this country. That took 60-plus years to build, and they're still working on it. And I think that we are engaged in a similar endeavor, and we have to both do the very necessary and important work that Cy does, but we have to look at this at a much broader societal level too.
Juan Manuel, I'm very optimistic.
You are.
I am. First of all, we are in a period where I am meeting with Khalil and Nick and people like that who are helping us, as Vera did at our office, shape policy. I think there is we are much more open to the help from thoughtful folks who are not wearing badges or prosecutors to help us do our job better. But clearly, we have a continued and huge issue of a lack of confidence in our justice system based upon racial equality. This is an opportunity for every office, district attorney, and every police department to confront the statistics and to talk openly about this problem and then move forward through it. Our biggest problem is being defensive and being incapable of acknowledging the problem we have. Once we acknowledge it, then there is a path forward, and that is to honestly talk about it and then thoughtfully address it.
Once again, fascinating, the documentary. The title is 13th. It's already in theaters and streaming on Netflix. Khalil Gibran Muhammad of the Harvard Kennedy School, Nicholas Turner of the Vera Institute, and Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance, thank you so much for your insights today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And coming up, religion and politics. Don't go away.